1 Kings 18 and 19 was what I asked you to read. These are stories, probably more so chapter 18 than 19, that we are very familiar with. The story of Elijah and his duel of the prophets, how he gathered together the 850 prophets of Baal and Asherah and challenged them to see whose God is the real God and could perform the demonstration of his power. And of course, in chapter 18, we know that Baal did not respond to the prophet's request for fire to be sent from heaven and to consume the sacrifice. But yet Yahweh did to Elijah's request and demonstrated without any shadow of a doubt that Yahweh was in fact the true God, that he was the powerful God. Baal was nothing. Yahweh was everything. But then we come to chapter 19 and we see Elijah go from being on the highest of highs with this great victory against the prophets of Baal and Asherah down to the lowest of lows. And he sinks to his lowest point here in 1 Kings chapter 19. And we are on the step of the seven steps. We are talking about protecting our zeal from Satan and from everything that would do its best to extinguish our fire. Last week we looked at various lies that Satan tells us. This week we're going to look at how to recover from burnout. Now let me ask you a question regarding burnout in general. And I'm not talking about just as it relates to our zeal for God and our efforts here, but this could be true in your work, in your family relationships. Mothers, especially those of you who have had teenagers, maybe. Do you ever feel like you get burned out? And this would be true for dads too. But parents in general, have you ever felt totally stressed at your family and all the stuff that your family is going through and you wanted to just get away from it all? Has anybody ever felt like that as a parent? Okay. Chuck was the first one to raise his hand. Of course, that wasn't with Tana. I mean, she was the perfect child, right? He's not answering. Gentlemen, specifically, you and your work, since most of the men here are the major breadwinners and the ones supporting the family, ever have a time where you were burned out with your job at a major stress level and maybe you had to change jobs because of it? Maybe you had to just say, I've had enough, take this job and shove it. And you were out the door. You got burned out. Burnout can happen to all of us in various facets. How does that happen? What leads to burnout in general? Please answer. Complacency? Okay, what do you mean by that? Maybe that starts to wear on you after time. Okay. James? Okay. And what leads to the stress that would lead us to burnout? Everything, Maddie says. Okay. Ben? Okay. That can certainly have a role in it. It's doing the same thing over and over again that you don't see is getting you anywhere. Okay, that could certainly lead to it. I heard somebody starting to say something over here. Okay, the amount of time that you put into whatever this project is, whether it be your family, whether it be work, whatever. I mean, you're putting in a lot of time, a lot of effort is being expended, whether or not that effort is being rewarded or not. You're spending a lot of time and effort in this, right? And therefore the stress from the job. Tom?
With your job really requires 25 hours a day, 8 days a week, and the job still requires.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
Okay. Yeah, just too much work and not enough time to do it in. The common denominator amongst all of this, and we could go one talking about various factors that lead to burnout, but the common denominator, no matter if you're a mother, a father, a spouse, and you know, you can get burnout in your marriage too. You know, you brought up last week about these points also apply to our marriages. And whether you're talking about our job, all of this, the only people that get really burnt out are the people that spend a lot of effort in whatever this is that you're talking about. You're not going to get burnt out on something that you're just kind of half-heartedly doing and you're not really involved in, are you? It's not much to get burnt out on at that point. But something that's extremely important to you, something that is vital to you, something that you're spending time on, and especially when other people are involved in the process and maybe they're not cooperating or something is happening to where you're not progressing, all of that builds up to where you finally reach this boiling point and you throw your hands up in disgust and say, I'm done. And that's exactly what happened with Elijah. And he reached his boiling point. He reached the point to where he finally just threw his hands up and said, I'm done. And so let's take a look at that and why that is the case or why that happened to Elijah and how we can recover from it if it does happen to us. Preferably, of course, we want to keep ourselves from getting to that point. Recognize that we're getting to that point and try to stop it. But in case it does happen, how to recover from it. But in order for us to even be burnt out in our efforts to serve God, that absolutely requires that we have been working diligently for Him. Okay? For any of you who may just be lackadaisical in your service, you're not going to get to this point. And it would be better to be so zealous for God that you're in danger of burning out than it would be to just coast along and think that you're doing fine when in fact you're not. So, 1 Kings chapter 19, you have, well, if I can get to it. After the battle with the prophets, where does Elijah go from that point? Remember, he's up on Mount Carmel, but where does he go from there? Not yet, but before he goes there, the first place he goes when he leaves Mount Carmel is where? Well, before even before Beersheba. Before that, I'll just tell you, he goes to Jezreel. Okay, he leaves Mount Carmel and goes to Jezreel. Who's at Jezreel? Ahab and Jezebel. And remember Jezebel's reaction to what took place there with the prophets? And he said, I'm going to make you like one of the prophets. In other words, I'm going to make sure that your head gets chopped off, that you're a goner. It's at that point that Elijah flees and he goes to Beersheba and then into the wilderness and eventually ends up, Chuck, at Horeb. We know Horeb better by what name? Sinai. Okay? Now let me just, for geographical references to help you understand just how far Elijah went. He starts his journey in Jezreel, and he goes down to Beersheba first, and I looked at the map and saw that from Jezreel to Beersheba is approximately 116 miles. This is like walking from here in Gardendale to just over the Tennessee border. Okay? Around Pulaski, Tennessee, if anybody knows where that is. So you walk from here to just over the border into Tennessee, and then he eventually goes down to Horeb from the Beersheba area, which is another 260 miles. So this would be like you continuing from Tennessee all the way up to Louisville, Kentucky. How many of you want to go on a hiking trip to Louisville, Kentucky? I love hiking, and back in 98, me and my wife started hiking the Appalachian Trail. It's been my dream ever since I was about 10 years old to hike the entire Appalachian Trail, which is about 2,100 miles from Springer Mountain, Georgia, just north of Atlanta, all the way up to Mount Katahdin in Maine. It takes about 6 months to do it, 5 or 6 months. Unfortunately, 3 days into it, Lisa tore her groin muscle. So we didn't get very far. I made it to Tennessee, or to North Carolina, rather, but she stayed behind, and I finally came off the trail. Well, he went all the way from Birmingham to Kentucky, basically, to Louisville. And he ends up there on the mountain of God, and he is very distraught. He's in despair. And take a look at some of the things that is said about him there in chapter 19. Oh, technology, come on. First of all, what we see with Elijah in chapter 19 is he says that he was afraid. Verse 3, talking about Jezebel and what she says to him in verse 2. About, I'm going to make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time. Verse 3, and when he saw that, he arose and ran for his life and went to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. And he doubted his ability to continue. Verse 4, he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree, and he prayed that he might die. That's how low he was. He prayed to God, just kill me now. It is enough. Now, Lord, take my life, for I am no better than my father's. And we see in verses 5 through 8 that he was exhausted. He lay and he slept under a broom tree. Suddenly an angel touched him and said to him, arise and eat. He looked, and there by his head was a cake baked on coals and a jar of water. So he ate and drank and lay down again. The angel of the Lord came back the second time and touched him and said, arise and eat, because the journey is too great for you. So he arose and ate and drank. And then he went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights as far as Horeb, the mountain of God. And I take it from that verse that he didn't eat again for those 40 days. But he was exhausted. You ever been so stressed out and so burnt out that all you wanted to do was sleep? In fact, maybe your spouse had to wake you up just to get you to eat. And he felt frustrated and all alone. Look at what he says in verse 10. When God asked him, what are you doing here? He said, I have been very zealous for the Lord God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with a sword. I alone am left, and they seek to take my life. So this is the state he's in. He's scared. He's exhausted. He feels all alone. And he just wants to die. And this is considering he just succeeded with the greatest victory that you could think of in demonstrating that Yahweh was the true God. Why do you think that that Elijah went from the peak to the valley so quickly? I mean, maybe our natural reaction would be, hey, he ought to be on cloud nine and be even more zealous and continue on, but he drops. Why is that? Why did that happen to him? How did that happen? Say it again, Steve. The fight is never ending. Okay, I think that's right. Did he end up with a response that he thought that maybe should have happened as a result of that battle with the prophets? No, Jezebel says, yeah, right. Killing you, dude. It didn't matter, apparently, in his mind, that all of that success, because it was for naught, apparently. What else can you do at that point? You've reached the highest high. Where else can you go from that point is what he's thinking. Anybody else? Okay. But he says in verse 10, I have been very zealous, but yet look at the result. Nothing is really changing. And so, what good did it do me, in other words? Okay, so what did he have a problem with? And how can we avoid that problem? How do we recover from it? First of all, what we need to understand is that burnout is more than just being completely stressed out. Burnout is a fundamental breakdown in the heat source, in the fuel, and the environments that are needed for a spiritual fire. Remember those three parts of the fire that make up the fire triangle? You have to have the heat source, you got to have the fuel, and you got to have the right environment. And he had a breakdown in all three areas of that. And let's talk about that for a moment. His fuel problem, his zeal was dwindling. Jezebel shattered his courage. Remember we talked about the courage that we need to continue on and to stand up for what's right? I mean, he had been very courageous up to that point, but then Jezebel said what she said, and it's like, oh, it's never ending. I'm not going to succeed. In fact, I'm going to end up being killed. So his courage left him. He walks for 40 days. If he were to walk from here to Louisville, Kentucky, do you think you might be a little bit exhausted? Yeah, and without eating, except for just the meal you had just before you left. Yeah. He was exhausted. We talked about, I think, Chuck, maybe this was your lesson, was about energy, about reclaiming our energy and the steps that we can take in order to stay and maintain the energy that we need in order to zealously serve God. And we need to take a look at those things that are draining our energy and stay away from those things. Okay, well, his energy was gone. His prayer to God to take his life, what fuel was missing there that we've talked about? Diligence. Part of the definition of diligence is to keep on and keeping on and to stay on task, stay on target for you Star Wars fans out there. He did not have the diligence at that point that he needed. And then traveling to Mount Horeb, which if you were to look at the map, you have Israel up here, and Mount Horeb is way down here in the Sinai Peninsula. The environment, where did he need to be? It wasn't there. And what question did God ask him? I think at least twice, maybe even three times. I didn't count. What are you here, Elijah? You're in the wrong place. It's not where you're supposed to be. So he wasn't in the right environment in order to continue with what he needed to do. Okay, so here's the point for us, that when we are facing a spiritual crisis, when we are facing a potential burnout, when we are stressed and we want to throw up our hands in disgust and say, nobody is as spiritual as me. Nobody's listening to me. I'm doing all this work and nothing's happening. I'm working overtime for my family here. I'm really putting in all this effort in my family and my kids, raising my kids, and they're not listening to me, and they're not listening to me, and they keep on doing the opposite of what I say, and I'm tired of it. There's a breakdown somewhere, and that we need to identify where that is and try to address those problems, not just the symptoms of those problems. So, let's take a look at some things here regarding that. Go to 1 Kings 19 and look at verse 9 specifically. He's there on Horeb, and he went into the cave, spent the night in that place. Behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he gives that answer in verse 10 that we looked at. And in verse 11, you have the story of how God tells him to go out in front of the cave, to go and stand on the mountain. And it says, "Behold, the Lord passed by in a great and strong wind toward the mountains, toward the mountains, and broke the rocks in pieces before the Lord. The Lord was not in the wind." Then there's the earthquake, and then there's a fire. And then in verse 12, the New King James says, "A still small voice." Some of your translations may say the sound of silence. The Hebrew there is difficult to translate. And so whether or not it was actual complete silence or whether there was just a small wind, you know, like a breeze, or what exactly there was is not sure, but it stands in stark contrast to the fire and the earthquake and the breaking of the rocks and all this huge noise and so forth. What is the point of all that? What is God doing What is he trying to get across to Elijah there? What does this have to do with anything? I think Karen's exactly right. In case you couldn't hear what she said that Elijah apparently wanted something grand from God, major judgment, destruction, you know, take care of all these wicked people. But God doesn't always work that way, does he? Sometimes he works on a completely different time and on a different magnitude than what we would want from him or expect from him. And sometimes it's behind the scenes, these little small, insignificant in our mind things, that maybe things we don't even see, that God is doing behind the scenes to accomplish his will and to make sure that what he wants to happen happens. We want to see some big grand demonstration. And we want to see judgment. We want to see things happen right now. I mean, we are a very instant gratification society. Steve? We want to be here, that's our goal, but to get there, you got to do this first, and then this, and then this, and then this, and then this. And we can't jump from here to there. And God doesn't always jump from here to there. And his process and what he is trying to accomplish, you know, his thoughts are above our thoughts, and his ways above our ways. We don't know every way in which God works. We don't necessarily understand it. But we've just got to trust in God that he's going to take care of whatever situation. His will be done. Tom? Yes. He was in a pity party, wasn't he? He was throwing a pity party and nobody came. And he was wallowing in that pity and just was ready to give up. But this demonstration by God of the things that happened on the mountain and then either the silence or the breeze or whatever it was that took place in contrast to the fire and the earthquake and so forth, I think it's just God's way of saying, I work in a multitude of ways. You just got to put your trust in me that I'm going to take care of it. All right? And then you do what you got to do. I'll do what I got to do. By the way, let me make a little side note here. And I don't know if Bruce or Ben brought this up when they were covering this passage. Verse 12, the still small voice, it is extremely popular in the religious world today to refer to this verse. And people will tell you, you've got to listen for God's still small voice telling you what to do. First of all, it's not even 100% certain that there was a still small voice. Like I said, the Hebrew there is difficult to translate. That comes from the Old King James, New King James. Other translations say it differently. The Bible never, never talks about God speaking to us directly like that, giving us revelation. Only certain people got that, the prophets and so forth. Not you and me, certainly not today. Do we need to pay attention and be observant of how God is working in our lives? Sure. But if you're listening for voices, the only voice you're going to hear are the voices in your head, which, you know, can tell you all kinds of crazy things. Right? And, you know, there are so many people that have acted upon supposedly what the Spirit told them that goes against Scripture Or then they're not having success with whatever it was that the God told them to do, and, oh, well, maybe I didn't hear God right, and now he's telling me to do this over here. And the Word, guys, the Word, that's where God's voice is, not in our heads. So just wanted to bring that up as a little aside since we were talking about that verse. But anyway, what you have here is that God is trying to tell him, I work in different ways and than what you're necessarily expecting. One of the problems that Elijah had and that we sometimes have is that we're not close enough to the heat source. We need to stop and we need to meditate. We need to talk to God. We need to read his word. Time alone with God and get back to the heat source. We have burnout. We're ready to just throw in the towel. It's time to stop and drop on our knees and approach God in prayer. It's time to stop and read his word and get back to the source of our zeal, get back to that heat source that will reignite us and get us going again. Okay? Does that make sense? Questions, comments about that? And then secondly, see God, and actually see God working in his time and his ways. That's the point of what we were just talking about, that not everything is going to happen in our time frame or in the way that we expected. And then there's certain fuels that we need to have, that we need to make sure are still burning. All those fuels that we looked at, those characteristics of Jesus that we need to embody. And one of those is service. And one thing this story tells us and teaches us here in 1 Kings 19 is that Elijah was shirking his responsibility. Two or three times God asked him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" The implication in that is, you're not supposed to be here. You're supposed to be up working. And what does God tell Elijah to do at this point? Not only does he ask him, what is he doing here, but he then commissions him to do something. What does he tell him to do? Since everybody read 1 Kings 19 before today, I know y'all all know the answer to this. Say that three things. What were those three things? Okay. Anoint the new king of Aram, Syria. Mm-hmm. Anoint Jehu to be the new king of Israel. And Elisha as his successor. You've got work to do, Elijah. Get up off your rear end. Get out there to where you're supposed to be and do it. Okay. With burnout. And I experienced burnout just a couple years ago myself. I hit this point where I didn't want to talk to anybody. I didn't want to talk to Lisa. I didn't want to talk to my kids. I didn't want to talk to anybody from the church. I just wanted to be in my room by myself and sit there and wallow in my own pity party. I had a pity party a couple years ago. And finally, somebody was good enough to come to me and said to me, "You need to get up off your rear end and get to work. You've got a job to do. Quit wallowing in your pity party and get out there and work." And it's amazing that if we will just do that, that helps to reignite our zeal. Service. We have things to do. Get out there and do it. And then finally, remember, you are not alone. Elijah said, "I'm the only one left." Was he correct in that? No. What did Elijah know? If you go back to chapter 18, what did Elijah know that he was either forgetting or overlooking when he said to God, "I'm the only one left"? What statistic did he know? There were 100, at least 100 prophets that Obadiah had hid in a cave that were loyal to Yahweh, not to Baal. Now, I know 100 in the great scheme of things and the great number of Israel is not a lot, but was Elijah alone? No. And then what does God tell him here in 1 Kings 19? He had 7,000 that had not bowed their knee to Baal. That either you don't know about Elijah or that you're forgetting about, you're not alone. And one of the reasons, I think, one of the primary reasons that God in His wisdom instituted the church is for this right here. That we can lean upon each other and gather strength from each other and realize we're not alone. Now, on Mondays, it may feel like we're alone when we're out there. On Thursdays, it may feel like we're alone when we're out there. But why does God have us to come together? Can you worship God by yourself in your home? Can you sing to God? Can you pray to God by yourself? Can you technically partake of the Lord's Supper by yourself in your home? Can you, of your own funds, support people and preachers or charitable organizations or something and help those who are less fortunate than you? Can you do that on your own? Yeah. You can do all that by yourself. So why don't we come together? One of the reasons is to help one another, is for that support system, because we need to understand that we are not alone. So when we are feeling stressed out, and I can't stress enough again, that the only way you're ever even going to get to a point of being close to a burnout is if you are working diligently, if you are zealous, if you are spending a lot of time in your efforts to serve God in whatever area, whether that be evangelism, whether that be in helping your family and building a good spiritual family, as the leader of the household, as the mother with the children, being an example to those about you, in good works in the community, good works amongst the brethren here, helping those who are in need, whatever you find yourself doing for the Lord, you're working hard at that, you're going to eventually get to this point where you're stressed and you're ready to throw in the towel. When that's the case, this is what we need to do. We need to recognize, okay, I'm having a breakdown in my environment. Maybe I'm not surrounding myself with the right people. Maybe I'm out of place. I'm not actually out there working. I need to stop and I need to pray. I need to look at those characteristics of Jesus, the courage, the diligence, the wisdom, all those things we've been talking about, and see where I'm lacking and put that another log on the fire. And that will either keep us from being completely burnt out, or it will help us to recover and pull ourselves out of that burnout stage and get back to work. Danny? That's right. Yep. Which is kind of surprising considering what had just happened in chapter 18. I mean, how can you go from being so bold to being so scared? But again, the results were not what he thought they would be, and he got scared. Ben? Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that he told him to do about appointing Elisha as his successor, the implication there is that God's work is going to continue, and God's going to, and with appointing Jehu, I mean, that is going to be the one that God has appointed to take care of Ahab and all the wickedness. Remember, and so all of these things that God tells him to do help him to get back on his feet and get out there and do what he needs to be doing. We're all going to get to a point at some point where we say, I've had enough. The key is, let's not stay there too long. And let's get back up on our feet and do what God's told us to do. All right, any final questions or comments before Chuck rings that bell? All right, thank you, guys.